ball towards left field. Going back fast is Kennedy. Kennedy gets there, and he takes it. And the Cleveland Indians are the world champions of 1948. And they are leaping joyously as they go off the field. Din is being mobbed, as are Lou Boudreau. And out in center field, Tucker and Kennedy come running in arm in arm.
Little tap up in the air, third base side, waiting is Tomy. Foul territory, the game is over. And the Indians have won the divisional title. Indian fans have waited 41 years. And now they can really cheer.
Now the pitch.
Swung on, line to deep left field. It is gone! You should see the celebration out of the Indians' third base dugout. Rajay Davis, a bullet, two-run homer down the left field line, clearing the 19-foot wall. We are tied at six.
This is Our Tribe History, presented by Progressive. A regular look back at professional baseball history in Cleveland since 1901 and beyond. Now, here's your host, Indians team historian Jeremy Fedor.
Hey, Tribe fans, welcome back to another episode of Our Tribe History, presented by Progressive. I am your host, team historian Jeremy Fedor. Now, I have a few interviews set up for some future podcasts, but in the meantime, I want to try something new. I have a lofty goal. I just kind of thought of it and thought it might be kind of a fun thing to do, is to try to cover all of our walk-off wins from every season starting back in 1901. Now, that gives me ample opportunity, if I'm kind of in a rut and need an idea for a podcast, to kind of dip back into this well. And I figure everyone loves a walk-off. Now, there won't be obviously any hammy calls until the 90s, but I figure, again, why not? Let's see what happens. And personally, I just find these fascinating, and they're easy to kind of research and chip off. Some of the earlier years in Baseball Reference, not so much, just because if you're familiar with Baseball Reference, they're working their way back. They're not quite at 1901 yet, but the information's still there, and then if you have access to other sources, you can kind of piece it together and go from there. So we're going to take you back to 1901. And now, mind you, I'm not going to be calling them the Blues. There really isn't any evidence that this team was ever called the Blues in 1901. And again, that's a whole another project of digging through recaps. And they recalled quite a few things, but never the Blues, at least in the Plain Dealer. And I think I have the Cleveland Press kind of scouted out too and didn't come across any references. But again, we're splitting hairs there, so we'll get out of the weeds on that. Now, the old news clippings from the Plain Dealer, and again, baseball writing at that time, it's very fascinating, and I think the writing is pretty tremendous too. And so for that very first walk-off win in American League Cleveland baseball history, that would be May 23rd, 1901. And I love the way the Plain Dealer describes the atmosphere of that game. It said, "There was a ball game at League Park yesterday afternoon. A few thousand Clevelanders may have an idea that they have seen many ball games on the same premises, but those who were not present yesterday will be voted mistaken by those who saw the game. Never in the history of the national game has there been a more sensational finish than the one that the Cleveland team made yesterday. And never before did the same size audience show as much inclination to go totally insane or give a better oral demonstration of the inclination." So again, not familiar with walk-offs, and you get to, you know, witness one after that terrible 1899 season, where I don't even know if they would have had a walk-off. I'd have to go back and see if the Spiders did anything. But nevertheless, this excitement and this win was really something to behold. And with most of these, the paper again sensationalizes the game as the greatest, and again something that's not going to go away in a lot of these accounts. So what was the big deal of that game? Well, going to the bottom of the fifth, Cleveland Club was trailing 9-0. So fans were right to think that the game was mostly over and that Cleveland just needed to play out the last few innings. Now, give credit to where credit is due. Pitcher Bill Hoffer surrendered 14 hits, 13 runs, 10 of which were earned, and struck out 0 Washington Senators. Hoffer, the 30-year-old native of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, was on his last legs. 1901 would be his last season in the American League. The five previous seasons were spent in the National League. Now, he did hold the distinction to be the first losing pitcher in an American League game when Cleveland lost to Chicago earlier that season. Cleveland and Chicago playing in the first American League game. I'm pretty sure that most of the other AL games that day were rained out, but Cleveland and Chicago managed to get that first one in, and the rest is history from there. But back to the game. So Cleveland did manage to put up 4 runs in the bottom of the fifth when Frank Schiebeck, a guy named Truck Egan, Hoffer, all knocked out hits, while Jack McCarthy walked, Bill Bradley and Candy LaChance all hit safe, and Washington had some errors by a few of their players. And that all contributed to the 4 runs for Cleveland. Now, after the 7th inning, Cleveland was down 11-4. And going into the bottom of the 9th, Cleveland was down 13-5. So you easily could assume that this one was played out. But again, it's why you never leave a game early. And the paper then recaps that final inning. It said, Cleveland faced what seemed to be the inevitable in the 9th inning. The spectators had it all figured out how the home team had lost the game. Bill Hoffer had been hit quite freely and his support had been wretched. 4 errors were charged to the Cleveland fielders and 14 hits against the pitcher, and Cleveland was only a little matter of 8 runs behind. That is, it required 8 runs to tie the score and 9 runs to win when the last half of the 9th began. So again, things didn't look great for the Mudville 9. Fans were leaving the stands, and the few that did remain stayed to boo. But those boo birds soon started to cheer. And so Hoffer was the first man up in the 9th, and from the bleachers came such sarcastic remarks as, "Win your own game, Hoffer. Hit her out, Hoffer, and run around 9 times. Then you'll win." Hoffer then struck out. So wasn't helping his own cause there in the 9th. The remainder of the crowd began to start for home when Ollie Pickering was thrown out at first. So you have 2 out, bottom of the 9th, you're down by 8. I imagine the win percentage is pretty small. So Jack McCarthy sent a clean single to right field, and it said the spectators were offended. It seemed like a useless delay. And some of these spectators took the adage of never leaving the ball game early. So you're kind of, you know, 1 foot in the door, 1 foot out of the door. Bill Bradley hit another one safe, and the opinion was that the players were only trying to help their batting averages. But then Candy LaChance, after going after 2 bad ones, pounded a single to center, and McCarthy crossed the plate. Bob Wood was hit by a pitch, and then the bags were full, but even then, no one had the slightest hope of pulling the game out of the fire. Frank Schiebeck, however, hit the ball square on the nose for a double. Frank Jennings cracked out a single. Patton was taken out of the box and Lee substituted. Truck Egan took a walk. The paper described it as 4 bad ones, so 4 balls. And Irv Beck, who then was batting for Hoffer, sent the ball close to the left field fence that Foster could not handle it, and the runner took 2 bases. In the meantime, 7 runs had been scored in the inning, and 1 more would tie the game. Pickering then singled, and Beck went home. By the time the audience gave a life-size picture of the pandemonium, let out for recess. Crowd roared and jumped and shouted, and goes on to describe some of the things that were then thrown into the air, such as hats, umbrellas, canes, cushions, that went up as if a cyclone had struck the part of the landscape. So again, you think of these good old days of well-mannered people, and it was certainly not. It was pretty rowdy. So If you're there, you're dodging hats and umbrellas and I guess people tossing their canes, although I'm not sure how they're going to get home if those were canes that were needed to walk. But so you have to dodge those. And again, going back to that, the crowd, it mentioned that they also rushed the field and came close to forcing Cleveland to forfeit. You had these fans just kind of chilling on the field. The paper mentioned, too, that Pickering's single would have been good for a triple, but it went into the crowd, and the game was stopped until the field was cleared. And then it was McCarthy, who was the man who was given the opportunity of batting in the winning run, and he accepted it. A single to left sent Pickering across the plate, he having gone to second on a pass ball. The demonstration that followed may be imagined. It cannot be described. The oldest fans fail to recall similar finishes on Cleveland grounds. And mentions a game in Boston. The old Cleveland team won a game making 9 runs off a pitcher in the 9th inning. Another game in the 4th of July. But again, this was the American League club. And kind of came back to get the W. And a funny story or an odd story, it mentioned that Truck Egan, who I think's got a great name, played second base, had just arrived from Pittsburgh and is under contract to Cleveland. The management sprung Egan as a surprise, and no one outside the inner circles knew that he was expected here until he arrived. Now, Egan had only 4 more games with the club. He played his final games about a week later on May 30th. So, maybe that surprise just didn't work out too well for the guy. And in that attendance, it mentioned it was 1,250. So not a very large draw in that 1901 first walk-off game. So I imagine any sort of commemorative ticket stub or anything out there is non-existent. And that was walk-off number one. Now, walk-off number two, also 1901, has our friend Bill Hoffer back on the mound. So you have the same pitcher for the first two walk-offs. And now, mind you, he had only 3 wins that entire season. So 2 of those wins were last-second walk-offs and kind of helped him out from having a worse record than what's recorded. And so that second walk-off was also the second game of a doubleheader on July 4th, 1901. Cleveland had put up a 4 spot in the second. In that inning, LaChance and Bradley singled, and Bob Wood, he sacrificed and mentioned his out, advanced both runners. And then there was a single that scored the 2 runs, but then the paper kind of forgets to describe how the other 2 runs were scored, so you're kind of left with your imagination. Sometimes the descriptions are a little more detailed, and sometimes they're a little bit off the walls. Nevertheless, in the 6th inning, Chicago tallied one run across the plate, and Cleveland got that run back in the bottom of the 8th. However, disaster then struck in the 9th when Hoffer gave up 4 runs. It said, Chicago made a rally in the last inning of the second game that gave the Cleveland Rooters several kinds of symptoms of heart disease. So again, the flourish of the writing back in 1901, it's wonderful, and I think it adds a little bit of color sometimes to these drab recaps at times. Again, it was Hoffer who surrendered all runs in the 9th. He went 9 innings, surrendering the 5 runs, 4 earned. But this time he actually struck out 3. So with 2 outs and Herm McFarland on first from a walk, Zaza Harvey, William Hoy, and Fielder Jones singled, and Sam Mertes hit for a triple to score the 4 runs for Chicago that tied the game. And eventually they got out of the inning, but the game was tied. So it's like Cleveland had to work to get that run back to win the game. And for them, it was McCarthy was the first man to bat, and he ended up flying out. So Jack O'Brien got on base via walk, but was forced out by Irv Beck's next at-bat. But Beck ended up going to second on a wild pitch, which allowed Candy LaChance to hit that clean single, and Beck trotted home. And if you're interested, his real name was George. I think it was according to his Sabre bio, mentioned that he preferred to chew on peppermints instead of tobacco, hence earning the name Candy. So that was walk-off win number two. Perhaps the most notable walk-off took place on July 19th when former Cleveland star Cy Young was on the mound for Boston. Cy Young, the native of Tuscarawas County, and obviously Cy being in the news lately with Shane Bieber winning the American League Cy Young this year. So a lot of Cy Young just kind of popping up for you, and rightly so. He was quite the pitcher, and even if old Haas on Twitter doesn't care for him. But on the mound for Cleveland was a guy named Earl Moore. Moore was a rookie out of Pickerington, Ohio. And actually has a very fascinating bio on the Sabre website. So those are linked down their baseball reference page as well. So I'll tweet that out. It's fairly detailed, and Moore had quite a decent career. So if you want to check that out, I will tweet that out when the podcast comes out and give it a read. Again, that's a fascinating project that Sabre has, these bio projects. If a player doesn't have a biography, you can, you know, call dibs, research it, and write the bios that go on their website. The Hall of Fame carries a folder for every player that's played in the major league, so you can get your hands on that, and it's a whole lot of fun. So just throwing that out there, making a plug. But nevertheless, Cleveland scratched across their first run in the first when Ollie Pickering gave third baseman Jimmy Collins a hard stop that he made gracefully. But then he chucked the ball 4 feet over the first baseman's head, and Pickering went to third while the fielders were chasing it. He then scored on a ground out. Then Cy retired the next two batters, all on infield assists. So that was a 1-0 game carried to the ninth when Boston's Jimmy Collins singled, stole second, and then there was one out when the shortstop Cleveland fumbled Freddie Parent's grounder, which allowed the runner to be called safe. During this time, Jimmy Collins took third. Hope Ferris, one of Boston's youngsters, hit a fly to Pickering, and a splendid throw of the plate should have caught Collins, who ran from third, but Bob Wood allowed the runner to knock the ball out of his hands, and thus the score was tied 1-1. And then the next man was thrown out at first, and that was it for the ninth inning. Cleveland didn't walk it off in the ninth, so we go into extra innings for our first extra innings walk-off in American League Cleveland baseball history. And in that 10th, Cleveland started out with a flyout by LeChance. So with one out, Bill Bradley hit a ball to left field that said brought every loyal fan to his feet. It looked as if it were going over the fence, which would have been the first walk-off home run, but it struck about 2 feet from the top and bounded back, holding the runner at second. So missed that first walk-off home run by about 2 feet. Next was Bob Wood. Now, if you remember, Bob Wood's the catcher who dropped the ball literally in the ninth when that run scored that would have ended the game. So Bob had the opportunity of the game and made the most of it. He drove a line hit to right and Bradley scored while a crowd of players and spectators were trying to shake the hands off Wood. So again, in these early games, fans were freely milling about the fields. And going back to one of the earlier podcasts in the 1920 World Series, I mentioned about Smokey Joe Wood, and there's this famous picture of Smokey Joe warming up before one of his World Series, I think it was one of the World Series with Boston, or when he was on his win streak, and there's just this crowd of fans around him, and it's a fascinating photo. You can Google that. I'm sure it'll pop up pretty easily. Nevertheless, Earl Moore had a heck of a game out-dueling Cy Young. I imagine that is something you tell your grandchildren about. Moore went 10 innings pitched, recording 5 hits, 1 unearned run, and 3 strikeouts. So, again, that's a heck of a game for a young pitcher. I also didn't think about it, but that's also a game of two starting pitchers, both born in Ohio. I'm not sure how much that happens anymore, but it's an occasion of that. And we reach our last walk-off of 1901. So clearly 1901 had 4 walk-off wins for a Not very good Cleveland team. Now, this was the answer to a trivia question I posted on Twitter that who was the first Cleveland pitcher, at least in the AL, to make his MLB debut, get the win, and also have the walk-off, get his win for a walk-off and get that walk-off hit. A gentleman named Jack Bracken. So this was a local kid, son of Irish immigrants, and 1901 actually ended up being his only year in the American League. But nevertheless, he picked up the win in this game, and later in life, I found this interesting. He's another one of those players that has a Sabre biography, and it mentioned when he moved to Michigan, he did a little scouting for the Indians, which eventually led to the club picking up Steve Gromek. So a little full circle there with Jack Bracken. Now, opposing Bracken was Bill Reedy, who also was of Cleveland birth. And Reedy eventually went on to help coach Cleveland pitchers, according to an article in the 1915 Plain Dealer. But he died pretty young at 42, not long thereafter. And he actually had to leave his coaching duties because of his ill health. So you have, again, another instance of not only two Ohio guys pitching against each other, but you have two Clevelanders. And the Plain Dealer actually loved this Cleveland matchup. It said, quote, "Seldom has a game at League Park been attended by such a sensational finish as with that of yesterday, when two Cleveland boys, an East Sider and a West Sider, faced each other in the box. The East Sider in the person of Jack Bracken, McLear's latest find, winning out by a score of 5-4. So again, that eternal struggle between the West Side and the East Side. Paper also said that it was the most auspicious debut for the well-built Kirkland Street youth. Not only did he hold the Brewers down to 6 scattered hits, upon which Milwaukee should not have scored a run, but he also won his own game with a corking two-bagger in the 9th inning. It was this same two-bagger, by the way, which was the cause of an exciting episode not down on the scorecard." And we'll get to that in a minute. The 9th inning opened up with the score 4-3 in favor of Milwaukee, with who other than Candy LaChance at bat. And he hit an easy one to Gilbert and was out at first. Bill Bradley, however, was not so easily disposed of. The second ball pitched to him, and he hit it for a single. And then when Connor came to bat, the crowd began to yell, "Wood, Wood." However, Cleveland manager decided to allow Connor to bat, and the ex-Brewer made a noble attempt, but he was robbed of a three-bagger, and the outfielder took the ball off the fence. The cries for Wood continuing, the popular catcher went to the plate in place of Scheibeck and rolled one between Anderson and Gilbert. Bradley going to third, and with two out and two men on base, how that crowd of 2,000 fans did yell as Bracken came to bat. So, again, down 4-3, two on, two out, and you have the local kid in his major league debut, also the pitcher, going out there to see what he can do. "One ball," yelled the umpire, and that was all, for the next one was right where the Sandlot pitcher wanted it, and he lifted it into the left field. The wind caught it and carried it towards the bleachers, and by a lucky chance, however, it dropped right on the whitewashed line, scattering the lime in all directions, according to the Plain Dealer. And the fans went crazy, and it said the shouts could be heard at Public Square as Bradley and Wood ran home with the winning runs. Now, the part that didn't make the scorecard that the paper was referring to was several of the Brewers players going up to the umpire and insisting that he call it foul, and he mentioned that some of it was a pleasant and playful style of argument, with the third baseman and the shortstop grabbing the umpire by the shoulders and kind of shaking him. It said that it left him, the umpire, too breathless to even say, "That'll cost you $25. But then Hugh Duffy came charging from center field and said, breaking through the crowd, handed the umpire an expression of his regard in the way of a right hand to the back of the head. By this time, the Cleveland players had come to the umpire's assistance, and pitcher Pete Dowling landed a swift left behind Duffy's ear. And that concluded the hostilities as the police and the crowds interfered. The latter was becoming rather threatening, and the Brewers made a run for their bus. So again, these early games, you know, it's I sometimes think people have an idea that more prim and proper, but these games are pretty rowdy with bottles being chucked and obviously canes and umbrellas going in the air. And now by this point, too, in the season, the paper had started including some of these neat little tidbits about the game to fill in some columns. And I always find them fascinating because, again, some of these things, this is the only place where they're recorded. And something along the lines, it said that Bill Bradley tried to give the baseball a coating of dirt at the start of the game, but it did not work because the umpire threw out a new ball to the pitcher. And then there were a bunch of rooters from Kent, they said, causing a little commotion in the stands. You know, I love the term rooters and these rooter clubs that teams would have. And in this game, there was a large group of from Kent. And then mentioned, too, from the umpire, he had a quote in the paper. It said, "I certainly shall report the fact that Duffy struck me to President Johnson at once. The blow did not hurt me, but the intent was there. The Milwaukees have had it in for me all season. Last week's experience in Milwaukee being the worst during my career as umpire. The papers began it, and then the people and the players kept it up." So again, it wasn't safe to be an umpire back in the day. So after all that, I hope no one feels like, you know, tugging me by the arms or, you know, bopping me in the back of the head. I hope that was a fun topic to dive into. Only 100 and some odd more years to go through, but overall I think it's a unique way to incorporate some of those odd years of our history that aren't 1920 or 1948 or the 90s, but you know, we'll get to those years and those walk-offs eventually. Like I said, it's a slow burn on those, but it'll be helpful for me to still get those out and, you know, get some content in these cold winter months that we're going to have. I'm not sure I'll have a podcast out next week with the holidays, but until then, again, thank you for listening to this episode of Our Tribe History presented by Progressive, and go Tribe.
You've been listening to Our Tribe History presented by Progressive with your host, Indians team historian, Jeremy Fedor.